Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast on Sunday the 28th of November, and the UK has been well and truly battered by Storm Arwen. Today we're joined by Louis Curtsey, Non-Executive Chairman of Mast Energy Developments. How are you today, Louis?
I feel very well, yes, indeed. Not the most pleasant weather that we have at the moment. I was out on a site visit at Pybridge yesterday and felt the cold very, very well.
Yeah, indeed. It's been pretty grim, hasn't it? So would you like to talk us through what Mast do and how they can help the UK with reserve power?
Yes, of course. Mast has positioned itself in the area of reserve power. And I think this is probably one of the most discussed and contentious topics at the moment is energy. And if we look at what is happening to all the energy companies and all the environmental issues around it, so Mast looked at the energy situation, the energy scene, and saw an opportunity to position in the area of reserve power. And so why reserve power? Reserve power because that is probably going to be for the foreseeable future, at least, your best insurance in terms of energy security and energy stability. How does this come about? One might want to ask, and that's very simple. As we move aggressively towards implementing renewable energy solutions, which we have to, which is quite important, you also have to phase out the old conventional options in terms of coal and nuclear and others. As you do that, you also divorce yourself from the ability to have 24/7 delivery of baseload power. And that's where the reserve power is coming into, is to make sure that in those periods where you have disruption in the grid or where you cannot deliver the baseload as you would normally do, that you have these backup facilities that can stabilize the grid and that can continue to make sure that you have that baseload supply on an uninterrupted basis. And it's in that environment where we saw the opportunity, both from an economics point of view, but also in terms of playing quite a vital role in terms of ensuring and securing energy stability.
So in terms of, I mean, you're a relative newcomer to the market. I think you IPO'd in, it was April time now. And within a very short period of time, you've built quite a nice portfolio of sites, up to about 18.4 megawatts of actually installed progressive units. Do you want to tell us a bit more about how those sites are progressing?
Yeah, it's 18.4 and growing, if I may say so.
Yeah.
So we did. So just a little bit of history, maybe. I mean, we saw this opportunity a couple of years back already. And then we started looking for opportunities to get into this market. We identified Mast, which was at that time two entrepreneurs who were developing it. We bought into it, bought 65% of the original company, of the original Mast. And then the first thing that we did is to say, what are the key components? What are the critical components that we need to have to be successful with this? And we built that first. And those critical components were obviously a pipeline of projects, a few sites that we have under control and that we can start developing ourselves immediately. And then also to make sure that we have the right strategic relationships in the industry as such. In other words, secure the offtake side, which we did in advance with Statkraft. Secure your ability to roll out at pace, that we did with Clark Energy, to make sure that our EPC side is covered well. And then very importantly also to make sure that we have the capacity and the capability to continue building this. So when we had all of this together, and I'm putting it very in simplistic terms now, but when we had all of these key components, all of these fundamental building blocks in place, we decided now is the time to list it, which we did in April this year. We were quite successful in raising the capital that we required. That, of course, meant that we didn't raise money to go and do something that we want to do. We raised money to do what we already said we're going to do. And that is why we were able to start with these three immediate sites, which we have under construction at the moment, and to grow into the pipeline of a further, at least at this point in time, additional 71 megawatt that we are also considering for development at the moment.
Excellent. And you've got obviously funding in place in a relationship with Close Finance as well to fund these.
That's really important. I mean, one of the areas that we explored very carefully before we started, before we did the listing of MAST, was to look at what are our funding options apart from just going to the market to raise money. And one of the things that we did start develop at that time already is certain relationships into the debt and project funding side. And the one that we could bring to the table quickest and I think on the most favorable terms was the one with Close Brothers, which we announced a couple of weeks ago. Now, that facility would allow us to access debt and project funding on initially the two sites, Bordersley and Rochdale, but it's also set up in such a way that we can replicate that same model in subsequent sites that we want to develop.
I don't think you want to hear that it's going to be 29 degrees centigrade here and not a cloud in the sky, so I shan't tell you. So only the reason why we need electricity here is for the AC, but don't worry about that. Okay, so we have this business. We floated at 12.5p. We went up to 15p. We've gone down now to 9.8 pence, which is a market cap of £18.5 million. And you have the potential effectively to generate that in not just revenue, but profit over the next couple of years. So how do you see the story unfolding in that situation?
Well, I think the important thing to understand about what we're doing here is the fact that the business model that we're pursuing here is, from an investment point of view, is one where you are exposed to fairly low risk, because these are typically utility-like projects or utility type of projects. But yet we see, in if you go back to the announcements that we've made already, so I'm not divulging anything here which we've not shared in the public domain already. If you look at the initial IRRs that we announced, we were looking at 15, 16%. When we did the Pybridge site, when we started developing the Pybridge site, we said we would be looking at optimization opportunities for this. And we just recently, when we announced that this site is now going into steady state production, we were able to say that has already gone up to 21%. Now, if you look at the current environment, investment environment, any double figure IRR, any double figure return is not to be sneezed at. And so we think this will continue. We think that this is where the real opportunity is. Fairly low risk environment in terms of the business that we're doing. Good returns on the other side, as I've explained just now. And why are those returns there? Because the market is growing so fast. And we believe it will continue to grow. And we believe that the role that the reserve power will play over the foreseeable future will become even more important in terms of making sure that you have energy security and stability.
Yeah, and compounded internal rate of return of 21% when you're able to borrow against it is going to be pretty significant returns over a period of time. That's your intention, I presume.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a healthy position to be in from a financial point of view. Your ability to attract investment, the ability to access funding opportunities is just so much more because it's such a robust business case. And on the back of any robust business case, you should be able to access various or diverse spectrum of funding options.
Yeah, and the way this business will escalate and exponentially grow, because obviously you have to have something that is birthed, and then as it grows, it's going to grow exponentially, both from the revenue that comes from it and also then your ability to gear what you already have, as in borrow against what you already have, is going to mean that this is really going to go up in a straight line pretty fast once we start to see those revenues come in and the ability to build more. So hence, you've got 20 million megawatts now, but you're looking at 71 million to bring on in the next period of time. So how quickly do you think you're going to be in a position to enhance it by that 71 megawatts?
Yeah. So your earlier reference to the millions, is 71 million and 21 million. I would love to be in that position.
Sorry.
Would that be a gigawatt or a gigawatt? I mean,
we're gonna power the whole of the UK, and you can send the rest to Egypt, okay? Because we need it.
We're gonna export now. We're gonna start exporting.
It always reminds me of Back to the Future. Is it 71 million gigawatts or whatever?
So from 21 to 71, published our prospectus, we set a course there in terms of where we want to be. So we would ideally like to our initial aim is to get to 300 megawatt as quickly as we possibly can. The first sort of target that we've set ourselves is to get to the first 50 megawatt as quickly as possible. We're well on track to achieve that at the moment. We have around about 20 megawatt under construction at the moment as we speak, and we have another 71 in the pipeline that we are considering. As things look at the moment, and as things stand at the moment, we believe we will be able to reach that 50 megawatt quite soon. Now, and you're quite right. From there on, because this is not, I mean, what we're doing in terms of these sites, you know, they are very, very similar. So it's not like you have to reinvent the wheel every time that you construct and commission a new site. It is repetition. The challenge here is in two things: your ability to have an offtake for what you produce. Your ability to back that up with proper sites and proper production capacity. Now, we've covered both of those already. And the most important part is that we've covered the offtake side really well in terms of our relationship that we have with the Statkraft, and which is continuing to develop. But the second important part to understand is your ability to continue to optimize and your ability to remain competitive. And in that regard, I believe we've already set in motion certain initiatives and structures that will keep us very competitive in time to come as well. Because what we've done is we've already said several times in the past, and we have the benefit from a MAST point of view that we have that backing from Kibo to support us in this particular environment or in this particular focus area. And that is to enhance and transition our reserve power to battery, to long duration storage in time to come. And that initiative is already underway. We're working really hard on that. And I think that is a very, very important differentiator as well, to keep you relevant and to keep you competitive in the market as you're going forward, and to make sure that you also diversify or that you adapt and adjust as the technology and circumstance change over time.
So is it possible that these sites would then have battery units on them as well to store? Because I presume the way the gas peaker works is if you were to charge a battery in the middle of the night when gas is cheap, you would charge the battery and then you could discharge that same battery at a higher price at peak requirements. Is this a possibility or not?
Those are all possibilities. By using the right storage technology, you can optimize so many of these things. What you have mentioned here is just one of the opportunities that do exist that you can benefit from. But there are so many others that come into play as well when you integrate your gas peaker sites, your gas reserve, your typical gas reserve power sites with battery storage as well.
You said that not that ultimate goal, but the target that you're aiming for is 300 megawatts. I use 300 there, not 300 million, which is good. 300 megawatts. And we've talked, and it's been in the public domain, that it's £5,000 free cash per month per megawatt. I think that's what we agreed, yes? Now, I asked that question on the fact that I was reading some documentation there about that somebody's just paid $4,950 per megawatt for peak gas peaking there just recently in September, when there was major downside for lots of things, wind, nuclear, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a seriously higher price than we're dictating in terms of $5,000 per month.
Kevin, this is exactly the point. What we've done, and that's why we've been comfortable to be fairly forthcoming in terms of the financial side of our projects, in terms of what we see the possible returns could be, in terms of what we see the free cash flow is, because we've always modeled our business model on a very conservative base case. And we've made that point very clear in all our communication so far as well. Now, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. We've been, your operating time that is allowed per unit, normally, as a rule, due to environmental limitations and other municipal regulatory requirements, it's about 1,500 hours per annum. That has been lifted to up to 4,000 hours per annum. So so if you just go up to 2,000, to 2,500, as opposed to the 1,500 where we've been, where what we've used as the base case, that already tells you what we're looking at. Apart from that, if you look in terms of the organic growth, in terms of accessing and getting bigger market share, and what I've already indicated at the start of our conversation, the growing demand, the growing need for reserve power, then it's not rocket science to sort of see where this is going.
And the other thing about it, I guess, is that as with COP26 and all the environmental issues, as the drive for electric powered vehicles comes online and the demand on the grid is going to increase, then obviously there's going to be more demand and therefore there's going to be more requirement for gas peaking and for reserve power, right?
Well, for as long as we, this is quite important, for as long as we have not found something that we can replace something like coal-fired power station, your typical baseload suppliers and nuclear with, as long as we have as long as we don't have something that replaces that in the conventional sense of the word, your reserve power will remain really, really critical. And the bigger the demand. I mean, it's just logic. That demand is going to be there. It's not going to go away on the short to medium term, at least.
Yeah, I speak to Phil sometimes and I say, the electricity's off here, because in Egypt, zero reserve power doesn't exist. Okay, so I live in Egypt. I mean, I think if you go back to South Africa, you're in the same boat as well. Yeah. Zero reserve power. If there's no electricity, there's no electricity.
Yeah.
And exactly. End of story. So you live in a country in the United Kingdom where you have something that isn't normal in many, many countries and around the world. You know, obviously in the West, it is pretty normal, but in Egypt, my electricity goes off a few times a week. Maybe not for a long time, but it goes off.
And you soon realize how dependent you are on electricity when it's been off for a few hours. Don't you? You literally.
Yeah. I had to go out and buy one of these to make sure my mobile could work if my electricity went off, you know. And I've got friends who live in Lebanon and they've had no electricity for 22 hours a day for a month. No electricity, 22 hours a day. So if you don't have a generator yourself, effectively, you're stuffed.
Let's just use the circumstance of the day to just show how critically important it is. You know, we've just seen what is happening, the new radical turn in events, if I can put it that way, with regard to COVID-19 on the announcement of this new variant. If we live in a world where we have lockdowns on and off and on, to be able to communicate like we're doing now, we need electricity. To be able to make sure that things stay sort of intact and remain, keep on going, if we can't do these sort of remote communications and be able to work in a virtual world, as it were, we have a problem. We really do. So the whole thing about energy and electricity is not something that is diminishing in importance. It's actually just growing.
What I'm going to pull us back to now is the base case for this for MAST. Your target is 300 megawatts at 5,000 per calendar month. This is £18 million of profit, basically. So when we get to that point, now we're in a situation where your current market cap is going to be worth what you produce per annum in profit. Now, if this was a utility stock, we were talking about PEs of 20 or above, because it's a utility play. This is the reality of it. It's electricity. It's gas producing electricity, which goes into the system. So if that's the case, we're looking at a market cap of £300 to £400 million if you're not going to expand at all.
Yeah.
So this is the end game, I presume, or not the end game, because it's wrong to say it's the end game. It's the first phase, if you like, within the next sort of 2 to 3 years that you intend to be in that position. So, you know, the market doesn't seem to have got it because you've actually gone down from the time that you listed. So have you got any ideas why you think that has happened?
Well, I think for us, you know, there's obviously more than one, but I don't think there's just one single reason why this has happened. I think the most important ones are, first and foremost, we are in a time where the markets are not particularly performing. So it's a function of the market in general.
That's a very nice way of saying the markets are absolutely crap at the
So I think we did not escape that general situation that is prevalent at the moment. And secondly, I think it's to be expected that once we've listed and after the listing, there would be a little bit of a let's wait and see position, which will reflect in the share price pulling back a little bit, I would suppose. And I think people would be waiting to see whether we are able to deliver. And I believe we are. Their Pyebridge is up, it's running, it's producing. Other two sites is under construction. In fact, if I can put it this way, if we were to draw up a scorecard at the end of this year and say, this is what we explained in what we're going to do in our prospectus, and this is what we've done, we would be scoring really well on that basis. So I believe we are delivering. We are doing what we set out to do. And, you know, I think the as we move forward, that will also reflect in the share price as we move forward. So in terms of why did the share price pull back a little bit, I think it's a function largely of the current market conditions, but also in terms of, let's see if you can deliver on what you promised, and which I believe we are definitely doing at this point.
Yeah, so that's a good big picture view. So the sort of smaller macro view would be end of first quarter 2022, probably going to be have a net free cash flow of £1 million-£1.5 million per annum annualized, I would assume, based on your base case. Now, actually, we already know that the prices are significantly higher than that. So if we use the same analogy of this is a utility with growth, and used PE is a 20, then you're looking at a market cap of somewhere in the region of £30 million minimum without any upscale involved. Okay. So if that is the case and we're on £18 million now, then there is obviously potential upside. Now, if I was able to transport you to the end of the first quarter of 2022, how many more megawatt deals do you think may well have come?
Well, we're working to be in a position where we as to reach that first 50 megawatt in production, as I've said already, you know, as quickly as possible. We are more or less there with the first 20 megawatts, which I've explained, which leaves us with another 30 megawatt that we have to bring into the fold. So by the end of first quarter of 2022, I think that's what you said. Move on to that. So at that point in time, I would expect that we would have secured enough capacity to put into production to reach that 50 megawatt production figure. So that's what we're working on. That's the 71 megawatt pipeline that we're working on at the moment is obviously an aggregate number. There are various projects in that represent or make up that 71 megawatt. So we hope to be in a position where we can close enough, or secure, that's the word, better word to use, to secure enough out of that pipeline to at least bring us to that 50 megawatt target for next year.
So the situation then with your major shareholder in MAST is Kibu. Now, Kibu owns 55%, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Of MAST. And overall, there is 75% of the stock locked, basically, with Kibu and with other institutional investors, including the guys who started this in the first place.
Right.
So we have a small free float. We only have 25% as a free float. But the interesting thing that I just could not get my little brain behind was that Kibo's part of Mast is worth about £10.5 million. Yes, is that correct?
That's correct.
And Kibo's market cap is £6.7 million. So the question I'm asking you is, who stole the £4 million?
Ongoing investigation.
It's an ongoing investigation. Okay. It's a bit of a bizarre scenario in the market. You know, we talk about this being a very rubbish market, if you like, or it's crap at the minute. But this is really an anomaly. This is crazy, really.
This is a big flag, isn't it? Hello, market makers, take the value up. It's a bit undervalued.
Well, it's a mystery to me, to be honest with you. You're not the first person who's asking me that question, and I wish I knew the answer. I have been looking for that answer very actively and aggressively, not been able to find it yet.
Maybe on Monday or Tuesday, a few people will be looking for the answer as well. You know, so we will see. We will see. And obviously, these two are interrelated, and as Mast starts to achieve more and more of his objectives. So you're talking about 50 megawatts by the end of the first quarter, and maybe slightly more by the end of mid 2020, and slightly more by the end of 2022. Then we're in a situation where Mast should be worth, I don't know, I'm guessing here, 40, 50 million at least. And Kibo ultimately should be worth 25 to 30 million if it doesn't do anything else.
Yeah. Well, logic seems to dictate that that should be the case. And hopefully it does. Coming back to your reference to 50 megawatt, you know, we will certainly not have 50 megawatt in production by end of quarter, in production by end of the first quarter. But we certainly must have the capacity in place to get to that 50 megawatt production. That alone in itself, you know, if you just look at, I mean, assets that we are developing in Mast are not, these are hard assets. These are not, you know, it's in land and in infrastructure and in physical assets that are there. So it's tangible. So one would expect that it would translate also into more value for Kibo as we go along.
Okay, so I mean, I'm looking at this and just saying we're in a market and it's being shaken. You know, this market currently is really being shaken, and especially in the resource sector. It seems to be, I mean, myself and Philip been having this conversation over the last week or so that, you know, the resource sector, there are so many stocks out there that have value based on just the fundamentals of the companies that it's really quite bizarre. But this isn't dependent on striking that gold seam or getting that copper out the ground or, you know, digging up that silver or finding that lithium and bringing it out for the battery metals. None of the above, okay? It's a man-made thing. We stick a gas peaker on there, we set it up technically, and it feeds into the thing. So the risk criteria is minimal. You know, we are really talking about a utility stock. And in this type of market that we're in now, you have got to be a great safe haven. You know, for a market that is going up exponentially, the requirements are all there. The prices are even going up exponentially. And this is safe as houses. As you say, you're buying land, you're buying equipment, and all of that is producing an income with returns of 20% a year.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes towards enabling all of our lives.
You are ahead, you have cash, you've already started the process. And, you know, I don't see it stopping. You're going to achieve 300 megawatts, maybe 300 million megawatts. You never know. But 300 megawatts for sure. When is the if and but, and how quickly it's going to get there? We don't know. Okay. And you don't really know either, because I'm sure in this business, there are huge amounts of other opportunities going to come your way.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I mean, since we listed and to try and illustrate your point, when we listed, immediately after we listed, certain conversations, we could have certain conversations we couldn't have before in terms of accessing certain opportunities, accessing certain levels of funding. And then when we announced that that ByBridge is going into production, it's going into steady state production, again, a whole host of new opportunities opened for us, which we couldn't access before. And that is both on the business side, in terms of growing the business organically, but also in terms of accessing other funding opportunities, which is really important. And that's why we took so much time and so much care to get the fundamentals in place first, to get the key building blocks in place first. Because if we wanted to do that after the listing, we would just have been playing catch up all the time.
Yeah.
So we took great care to make sure that the day that we listed, we are ready to run and don't have to go and buy buy the equipment to participate in the race.
I mean, as an investment case goes, as you say, wrapping up, you've got highly attractive IRRs given the low relative risk of investment. All of the assets are in a safe jurisdiction in the UK, exclusive rights to purchase shovel-ready sites, and then locked-in offtake agreement guaranteeing floor pricing.
If I could just maybe comment on that one specific thing, and some of the research that has been written on MED already spent quite a bit of time on looking into that specific thing, and that is to make sure with that floor price locked into our offtake site, we guarantee the continued feasibility. That's the biggest risk mitigator that is built into this whole model, is that floor, that floor price on the offtake side.
So it can't go any lower than this floor.
Yeah.
And that floor produces internal rate of return of what?
That will vary. I mean, that will be difficult to relate that. I mean, it will depend on what the particular circumstances at the time. But the important thing is it leaves the business model economically feasible. Albeit, if we rely on the floor only, less profitable maybe, but it's still feasible. It will still be able to operate as a proper business.
Louis Curtsey, Non-Executive Chairman of Mast Energy Developments. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Phil.
Thank you, Louis. Speak to you again soon. Before you go, Louis, we have to ask you the famous question. What is your favorite Sunday roast?
Lamb.
Good man. How do you want it? Do you want it on the braai?
Well,
or do you want it in the oven?
Given where I come from, anything on the braai on the barbecue is a winner, whether it's a lamb roast or not. So yes, that would always be the preference. But
a bit of mint sauce,
of course.
Okay, gravy thick or thin?
I'm not a big gravy person, to be honest.
Oh dear. You're not a northern boy then.
Got to be as moist as possible.
No gravy.
Why would you destroy a perfectly good piece of meat?
Oh dear, we have to stop here.
As thou now moist.
If it's not got gravy, it's not a roast. Very good. The changes of different continents and different countries. We're all very different. Indeed. Anyway, it's been great to speak to you, Larry, and we'll speak again soon. All the best.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, that was good. It was certainly a nice investment case for sure. It looks like, I mean, as we talked about before, didn't we, the starting investing companies that have actually going to have some net profits and actual revenues in, you know, going forward.
Yep. I mean, if they hit their aim, even on their base case scenario, you're talking about EBITDA of £18 million a year. On a utility stock, that's 20 PE, which would be normal for a utility stock. You're talking about 360 million market cap. And actually, don't want to exaggerate, but the ceiling level has been moved, as we discussed with Louis there, from sort of 1,000 hours of use per annum from these things to 4,000 hours per use. So you could actually argue that the base case could go up 4 times. Now, that would be an exaggeration, I think. But even if it was to double, you'd be talking about going from 5,000 per megawatt hour to 10,000, and actually probably higher, because effectively there's no extra cost other than the gas to produce that extra 1,000 hours. So then you're talking about balloon numbers, aren't you? And we're talking now about an 18 million market cap company that really hasn't got much in the way of anything stopping it. It's just got to build them, you know, take some money out of them, build the next ones, take some money out of them, build the next ones until it gets there, because the demand is there.
Yeah.
There are articles there that one of the places needs 200 megawatts per 200 megawatts now, like right now, and it's not available. They don't have it. Nobody has it. It seems like not a no-brainer, but it really seems low risk and the chances of reward are very high.
So should we talk about the car crash that was Friday on the market? I mean, it reminded me a little bit of March 2020 when, you know, when COVID was announced. It was almost as if they announced that COVID, you know, there was a new pandemic. Obviously, we've had the new, as it's been dubbed now, Omicron. It always gets the letter from the Greek alphabet. So we've now got Omicron, which is, they're calling it the South African variant, or they've now, I think they've put 11 countries on the red list. So worrying times. I think Witty's just come out and said it's not as worrying as the Delta variant, which is an interesting one. I'm going to do a bit of reading on that to find out exactly what Chris Witty means by that. But yeah, certainly an absolute bloodbath, unless you were in obviously COVID stocks, which had a good day. I mean, things like MHC did well. And yeah, we had Novacyt, which was up about 30%, Synergen. So anything really in the COVID space, apart from, I think, ODX, actually moved pretty well on Friday, and rightly so. I mean, yeah, you know, that was the theme, wasn't it? So
you say it was a car crash. It was a car crash. My portfolio actually didn't go down on Friday, which was a bit of a shocker. I think many of the resource stocks that I hold at the minute are so cheap now that it's like, where is there to go? Yeah, okay, they can go down for sure, but you know, I look at Curis Minerals. It's valued now at £9 million, has 2.5 million of that as cash. So basically, you're now looking at Curis Minerals being worth £5.5 million. That's a bit strange.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The resource sector is just, if you've got cash on the sidelines, it's kind of like, you know, if you can call the bottom on some of these stocks, then there's going to be a big upside. But it's when, you know, we talked about a Santa rally at some point, you know, coming forward, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't appear that that's going to come anytime soon. It can change like the wind, and let's hope it does. But, and crypto has also taken a bit of a beating, hasn't it, in the last sort of 24 to 48 hours. So maybe there is going to be some correction, but at the moment, it's looking more like into next year. But yeah, it's flabbergasting just how cheap some of these stocks have become. I mean, Mila Resources was an interesting one, wasn't it? We talked about it,
yeah,
I think last week, that it was a newcomer to the market in the form of an RTO from NGM. It had a placing at 2.4 pence. And on the first day of trading, it went up to something like 3.435 or something. And then all of a sudden, bang, it came back down, and you can actually buy it sub placing price now. So until that churn has been removed, then it probably won't move up. But I was talking to the CEO this week, and we're trying to get him on in the next couple of weeks. And it does seem that one could be a very interesting play with a link to Bellevue in the neighboring, you know, it's contiguous with Bellevue.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched the video on Bellevue, this week. It's like, I think there's a 15 or 20 minute promotional video showing all the underground mines and the fact that they've got 3 million ounces now specified, and that's going to go up by, he kept saying, 60,000 ounces a month is how much their amount that they've got guaranteed in the ground, if you like, is going up. So it's going to be 4 million, it's going to be 5 million, it's going to probably be 6 million, maybe 7 million, who knows? Because there's a huge amount of gold in the ground there. And yeah, this is like a small spot right next to one of the parts of Bellevue. So they're looking, I think, from what you said to me, 250,000 ounces. And if 250,000 ounces is found, then the current market cap of, I think it's around 7 or 8 million pounds, is going to be laughable, you know. So, yeah, it's interesting. Very good jurisdiction in Australia. And you know, there's gold in the ground there. It's just how economical it is and how easy it is for them to get it out.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the presentation, it really is. If you look at that Kathleen Valley asset, it's literally just like a postage stamp right next door to many other miners in that area. You've got obviously Bellevue, and then there's four or five others very, very close to that. And it really does look like this is not going to become an actual producer. There's no intention. This is purely just going to be we've got this little postage stamp there right next to a producing mine with Bellevue. And it really does. I mean, if you look at the presentation, it says it's contiguous with that particular asset that Bellevue have got. And it does feel like that it's just being geared up to sink a few holes, get the diamond drilling rigs in there, get the assay results. And I'm hoping that there's going to be a news flow coming forward in the next sort of like, you know, 3-4 weeks that will then start to drive the price forward. And actually people will start to see the potential there, that maybe one of the other mid-tier companies will come in and recognize that this is a great asset that they would probably want to take and extend their kind of boundaries into.
That's right. One of the geologists we were talking to as well was saying there is so much processing power, like within a few kilometers, that there's no need for a plant. You know, even if they dig it up, go down into the mine and dig it up, it'll just go straight to someone else's processing plant and be processed, and the gold will be there. So this isn't going to be a company that's going to have to raise loads more money. It's raised its money. It's going to drill its holes. It's going to get to the point where there's 250,000 ounces or more of gold, estimated, proven, whatever scenario it is. And then someone's going to buy it off them for a lot of money, I think. You know, that's the general gist, I think, of this stock. And it's going to be worth tens of millions, I would imagine, if that is the case, because it's high grade gold. I mean, Bellevue grades are 10 grams per ton, I think. So it's like crazy amount of gold compared to, you know, the normal gold project is 1 gram per ton is feasible and people do it. But 10 grams per ton is like, wow, right out there. I don't know whether this particular one will be this high, but hopefully it's going to have an amount, yeah.
Yeah.
The other one was Horizontal.
Horizontal.
Horizonte Metals. I mean, how on earth did that go below placing price now when they just secured however many hundreds of millions of pounds in financing, $663 million to build this mine. And they managed to get financing of, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was like $145 million money in placing shares, I think it was. And who have they got? They've got Glencore and a whole roster of other big miners who have bought into this placing. And it's gone below placing price when, you know, we've been talking about internal rates of return. The internal rate of return on this is huge. It's like, again, I'm not going to quote the figures so you can read it in the RNS yourselves, but it's well, I think, into the 20s of an internal rate of return. Yeah. On this for an asset that is required.
Like it's become one of the world's biggest nickel mines. And if you look at it's got a 38-year mine life, and it could actually put them into Anglo-American territory in terms of nickel production output. And the other thing is there's another mine, the Familial mine, which is in Brazil as well, which is a nickel cobalt, I believe. And that has also got a 38-year mine life and is also one of the sort of in the top 10 size nickel cobalt mines. And one of I think one of the backers of this project has also put $25 million in for a royalty fee to actually create a feasibility study on that project. So it's not just a one trick pony. You know, as you say, when will the market wake up to the fact that this is pretty much de-risked or fully de-risked because they've actually got the money to fund production?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a bizarre one for me. I mean, if you have ever invested in Horizonte, you will have invested for this day. Like this day was going to be the day, and the share price has fallen, I think, from like 7.5p down to, I think it was 6.7p now. The placing was at 7p. So all these guys, including Glencore, have invested at 7p for nickel, which is effectively the highest, what is it, the highest weight amount in a battery for an EV is nickel. They need the most nickel. And nickel is, there is lots of nickel in the world, but not lots of nickel mines that are going to be in production.
Yeah.
So if you actually look at the nickel price as well, they did their base case on $16,000 or $16,000 and something dollars per ton. The nickel price this week was $20,000 and 200. And they did theirs on $16,000 and so many hundred. So that's already gone up 25%. And it's sitting there at $20,000 because now there isn't going to be enough nickel to produce these batteries.
Yeah.
So again.
Yeah, crazy. Anyway, moving on, week ahead, what have we got to look forward to? One for me is Ben. I mean, you know, obviously we talked to Adam Wilson this week, and the high wall miner was on site in West Virginia. So, and he was pretty, let's say, confident that he would be able to get first coal by Wednesday of this week. So what do we think about that?
Yeah, I mean, when we did the sums, if you remember back a month or so ago, we said that base case was 31 pence. So we're about 29
and a half. Did they get that memo? Did the market makers get that memo that they sat it at 31p and that was our predicted figures?
Maybe they looked at it, yeah. I don't know. But anyway, that was what we said. If it's absolute minimum base case, which was 22,000 tons per month, they've already taken an offtake agreement for that 22,000, but that offtake agreement can be increased. So yeah, we will see. Let's see Adam on Wednesday, whether that machine starts turning and the coal starts pouring. And yeah, and then come January, everything's going to start being processed and then shipped out on the train. Yeah, the one I'm looking for this week, and it's gone down, hit the bottom, boom, back up again, gone down a little bit and shown a lot of strength this last week is Chilbrands. I'm expecting some good news. The IR is also really, really improving in it. And, you know, we're seeing it sitting now at about 15.5p. But it's, in my view anyway, it's worth considerably more than that. And I know I said that when it was 80, 90p as well. So you have to take that with a pinch of salt. But I can't see now with the revenues that are likely to come from the different products that are also going to be launched, how this can sort of fail. We're going into a chill world and chill.com is going to succeed in my view. How long it takes, who knows? But for me, it's very undervalued. The whole resource sector looks cheap. There are so many different ones that look cheap. You know, we've talked in the past about Extract Resources, and we know that they're trying to get a 2 million tons of contained copper in Australia. And, you know, it looks like that's there. And there was another RNS this week proposing copper and gold on the top of the thing. So there's going to be a plan coming out of how that actually looks and how that big pit would actually be dug. And, you know, that's not just pie in the sky. That's Anglo-American. I've got an option to buy back this as well. So there are many different opportunities, I think. Even Besant, we talked about CMRS. You know, Besant have got a big buy in there on CMRS's Truly project. We've visited the Truly project ourselves. It's impressive. There's a lot of copper and a lot of gold there, and it's just a case of getting it out the ground. And as that happens, I think probably quicker than we anticipate, because the mine is already effectively built, then it's going to be exciting times, I think. What about you, Phil?
No, I think that's pretty much covered all the things we said. Just looking forward to hopefully seeing something, you know, the market return to some sense of normality. Good.
We will see.
Well, on that note, have a good rest of the weekend, and we'll speak in the week.
Yep, no problem. Thanks a lot, Phil.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.